Deuteronomy 16. Observe the month of Aviv and celebrate the Passover of the Lord your God, because in the month of Aviv he brought you out of Egypt by night. Sacrifice as a Passover to the Lord your God an animal from your flock or herd at the place the Lord will choose as a dwelling for his name. Do not eat it with bread made with yeast, but for 7 days eat unleavened bread, the bread of affliction, because you left Egypt in haste, so that all the days of your life you may remember the time of your departure from Egypt. Let no yeast be found in your possession in all your land for 7 days. Do not let any of the meat you sacrifice on the evening of the first day remain until morning. You must not sacrifice the Passover in any town the Lord your God gives you, except the place he will choose as a dwelling for his name. There you must sacrifice the Passover in the evening, when the sun goes down on the anniversary of your departure from Egypt. Roast it and eat it at the place the Lord your God will choose. Then in the morning, return to your tents. For 6 days, eat unleavened bread, and on the 7th day, hold an assembly to the Lord your God and do no work. Count off 7 weeks from the time you begin to put the sickle to the standing grain. Then celebrate the Feast of Weeks to the Lord your God by giving a freewill offering in proportion to the blessings the Lord your God has given you. And rejoice before the Lord your God at the place he will choose as a dwelling for his name, you, your sons and daughters and maidservants and manservants, the Levites in your towns and the aliens, the fatherless and the widows living among you. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt and follow carefully these decrees. Celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles for 7 days after you have gathered the produce of your threshing floor and your winepress. Be joyful at your feast, you, your sons and daughters, your men servants and maidservants, and the Levites, the aliens, the fatherless, and the widows who live in your towns. For 7 days, celebrate the feast to the Lord your God at the place the Lord will choose. For the Lord your God will bless you in all your harvest and in all the work of your hands, and your joy will be complete. 3 times a year, all your men must appear before the Lord your God at the place he will choose, at the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, and the Feast of Tabernacles. No man should appear before the Lord empty-handed. Each of you must bring a gift in proportion to the way the Lord God has blessed you. Appoint judges and officials for each of your tribes in every town the Lord your God has given you, and they shall judge the people fairly. Do not pervert justice or show partiality. Do not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the righteous. Follow justice and justice alone, so that you may live and possess the land the Lord your God is giving you. Do not set up any wooden Asherah pole beside the altar you build to the Lord your God, and do not erect a sacred stone, for these the Lord your God hates. Deuteronomy 17. Do not sacrifice to the Lord your God an ox or sheep that has any defect or flaw in it, for that would be detestable to him. If a man or woman living among you in one of the towns the Lord gives you is found doing evil in the eyes of the Lord your God in violation of his covenant and contrary to my command, has worshipped any other gods, bowing down to them or to the sun or to the moon or to the stars in the sky, and this has been brought to your attention, then you must investigate it thoroughly. If it is true, and it has been proved that this detestable thing has been done in Israel, take the man or woman who has done this evil deed to your gate and stone that person to death. On the testimony of 2 or 3 witnesses, a man shall be put to death, but no one shall be put to death on the testimony of only 1 witness. The hands of the witnesses must be the first in putting him to the death, and then the hands of all the people. You must purge the evil from among you. If cases come before your courts that are too difficult for you to judge, whether bloodshed, lawsuits, or assaults, take them to the place the Lord your God will choose. Go to the priests, who are Levites, and to the judge who is in the office at that time. Inquire of them, and they will give you the verdict. You must act according to the decisions they give you at the place the Lord will choose. Be careful to do everything they direct you to do. Act according to the law they teach you and the decisions they give you. Do not turn aside from what they tell you, to the right or to the left. The man who shows contempt for the judge or for the priest who stands ministering there to the Lord your God must be put to death. You must purge the evil from Israel. All the people will hear and be afraid and will not be contemptuous again. When you enter the land the Lord your God has given you and have taken possession of it and settled in it, and you say, "Let us set a king over us like all the nations around us," be sure to appoint over you the king the Lord your God chooses. He must be from among your brothers. Do not place a foreigner over you, one who is not a brother Israelite. The king, moreover, must not acquire great number of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them. For the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. He must not take many wives or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. When he takes the throne of his kingdom, he is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law, taken from that of the priests who are Levites. It is to be with him. He is to read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees, and not consider himself better than his brothers and turn from the law to the right or to the left. Then he and his descendants will reign a long time over his kingdom in Israel.
So what have you learned?
God has definite ideas, not so much ideas, but statutes would probably be a better word, for a king to be successful before him and to remain in his good standings. Especially not to gather up things that would resemble power and prestige and even wives, because all of those would bring trouble to him and his judgments.
Not to esteem himself better than his fellow man. Anything else?
Well, I've found a good answer to why you shouldn't have a Christmas tree in your house. If you, Deuteronomy 16, 21 and 22 reads, "Thou shalt not plant thee a grove of any tree near unto the altar of the Lord thy God, which thou shalt make thee. Neither shalt thou set up any image which the Lord thy God hateth." But if you translate that from the Hebrew, what you get is, "Thou shalt not fashion, set up, or fix an Asherah," which is a tree, particularly a pine tree, "any tree near the altar of Yahweh." And the altar in Jewish thinking is the table in your own home now, because we don't have an altar that, right? So thou shalt not fashion, fix, or set up a pine tree, any tree near the altar of Yahweh. Neither shalt you rise or establish any image or pillar, which is the Asherah, which Yahweh thy God hates. I think it's a very good argument for not having a tree in your home, because it's an Asherah. That's what the Asherah were. They were trees. Phallic symbols with green leaves, which were evergreen. So a symbol of everlasting life in pagan thought.
And so especially that German pagan source.
Yes.
More
but
German.
But it goes all the way back actually to Mesopotamia.
Yeah.
Asherah can be traced
way back. Way back during Abraham's time.
Yes.
Because remember the Asherah tree there?
Yep. So right there.
It's still, the history. It's very fascinating. With this one, the next chapter, very fascinating about interesting. The trees are very, very prominent in something that he has to say.
Yeah.
Sometimes we overlook it, not know those things. Anything else anybody's learned?
Questions, not learning.
Okay.
Yeah, questions. Things that we learned. Just questions.
What's the question?
Oh, we'll ask yours first.
Well, it says don't take many wives. Does that mean it's okay to have more than one, but not several?
Yeah, what's the definition of many?
In other words, don't be like Solomon and David.
Don't be like Solomon. Don't be like David. Neither one of them.
300 concubines.
Because that has gotten on. You know, what is a concubine?
A mistress, basically.
A bond woman.
A bond woman. Concubine is always a bond woman, not a free woman, a slave. Hmm. All right? Because if it's a free woman, there is no law against it. She's married to one man, and he's married to the one woman. A bond woman, a concubine, doesn't have the freedom to come and go when she wishes to come and go. It's not her choice. She's under bondage. Well, it's not a blessing from God. Remember? Don't want anybody to be bond. What he wants to do, he wants you to free people. That's what we're supposed to do, and that's what they should have done. But see, God does not intervene when someone wishes to go contrary to his will. What does God do? Let them go contrary against his will. They will pay a serious price. What happened to all the men in the past in the Bible who had more than one wife? Problem after problem after problem after problem. Okay? It wasn't designed for that way. In the very book of Genesis, we talk about the one man had two wives. Guess what? He had problems. What the problem was? Now he killed somebody. Remember? We won't go into that today because that's the Genesis. We won't go there today. But you understand, you know, what did Jesus say? In the beginning, it was not so. All right. So we go back to the beginning. What does it say? Adam, not several things were taken out of his body, so he had 300 wives. Just one. Just one.
And it was Eve.
There is no such thing as many. You don't have, men don't have many wives. In the New Testament, we have, what does Apostle Paul say? Ministers, you are to be the husband of one wife. Deacons, you're to be the minister of
one
wife. Bishops, to be a deacon of, a bishop of one wife. And that's, you know, that's the lion's share of the whole thing. Just because man in history, and Daniel goes through the book of Joshua, the book of Judges, you see, they didn't follow. They turned from the left. They turned from the right. When they turn from the left, you turn from the right, you're going to pay some heavy consequences. And about the king having more than one wife, guess what? He turned from the center. He turned to the left or he turned to the right, whichever, but you know, look at it. And he took on board that he should have. Now, will they pay a price? Sure. Now, what happens when a king becomes wealthy? Well, you know how Solomon got wealthy? He taxed and he taxed and he taxed and he taxed and he taxed. And that's how he got wealthy. That's the only way a king or a governor could actually become wealthy is by tribute. You had to pay tribute to serve under his command. Yes, Daniel.
So why is it the Torah doesn't specifically state one man, one woman? But the New Testament does, and it gives the example of Adam and Eve, but it doesn't actually say here, thou king shall have no more than one wife.
Yeah.
How come it doesn't actually say so?
Well, you have to go back to the book of Genesis, beginning. It does say that.
But here it doesn't.
That's because why is God doing it for? He asked, you gotta transgress the law. This is what's gonna happen. No more than one. If you're gonna do it, you're gonna have problems. He said you can't do that.
I'm sorry, I'm not quite following you. I know that in Genesis it points out there's one man, one woman. I understand that. That's not my question. As the Messiah said, in the beginning God made one on one. Why is it that Moses, in his beginning from Exodus onward, does not explicitly state, with the exception of the high priest, does not explicitly state one man is to have one wife, no more than one? How come he never says so? I'm saying this as a high priest.
More likely, it probably was understood. We got to go back at that point in time in history. More than likely, it's probably pretty well understood. That's what you're supposed to do. Just because he transgressed the original command doesn't justify that.
But it never got changed in Judaism. For example, in Germany, it was about the year 1000 CE, where the rabbis, because they were living in a Christianized society, they condemned plural marriages then, but not until 1000 CE.
I don't have any. As far as Judaism is, it went to the left and went to the right anyway.
But
so in their life.
But I can see what you're saying, because it wasn't explicit in Torah.
If the Torah had stated that within Moses' time, they had been married multiple women, that wasn't unheard of. I mean, look at, Jacob. Okay?
Yeah.
He existed long before Moses. He had four wives.
All of the sons had more.
And he had a lot of problems, too.
I'm not saying he didn't have problems. I'm saying because Moses didn't specify, hey, one man, one woman, he could have, because he knew that men did that.
Where does the commandment that says you shall not commit adultery fit in?
Unmarried people.
No.
But Daniel,
if I'm not married to you, I'm married to somebody else, well, then I commit adultery. Not you.
No, have a sexual relationship with somebody else that's not your wife or your husband. That is the law.
That's what I'm talking about. Right. But since it didn't specifically state, well, I'll just marry 500 women. Or it's got excessive. Well, I realize that. But to get a point across, well, I could have sex with all 500 of them and I'm not committing adultery.
Are you going contrary to what God said here? Do not have.
To do Deuteronomy? Well, it depends. What's many? Is more than five. Is that too many? Okay, so I marry five women. I look at Mormonism.
Singular. Daniel also.
Mormon is completely contrary to what the truth is.
Well, show me.
All throughout the book of Proverbs, a good wife, not plural, who can
singular.
Find?
Always single.
Also, it says it's better to live on a corner of a roof than to live with a nagging wife. And again, it's singular.
It is singular, that's true. But how come it's not in the Torah? You know what I mean? Why did Moses say something? He had the easy opportunity to do so. He could have corrected it generations ago, but he didn't. So it took thousands of years before they voluntarily said, okay, we'll stop this practice. It just seems odd.
Yeah. I grant it just seems odd. I don't have a complete answer to that one because it should be there.
Well, an answer might be what we're currently facing with right now about specifying what marriage is. I mean, if we were having this discussion like 50 years ago, okay, a marriage is between one man and one woman. You know, our parents, our grandparents have said, duh. You know, but now today we actually have to specify what we mean by marriage. Because today people have no clue. So there was a time period when the prophets and the judges were coming down where they actually had to specify, because people either whatever, they had gotten away from what the true meaning of the Torah was, and they actually had to be specific. Okay, you cannot go to the altar while you're cheating somebody else. You know, just because you're doing your religious duty over here doesn't mean you get a loophole out of following the rest of it. You know, the prophets were like, really, they were judges. They were basically there providing the strict constructionist approach to the Torah, saying basically, this is what the Torah really means. Not what you think it means. This is what it really means.
This establishment of it.
So.
Okay, before we go any farther, I'll backtrack just a little bit. The 16th chapter. Just a little bit, because I don't want to rush this thing through at a very fast pace, but we'll get chapter 17 relatively quick, because that is the key thing I wanted to address today. All right. I want to go to verse 3. Usually, no leavened bread with it, meaning the Passover. For 7 days, you shall eat unleavened bread with it. That is the bread of affliction. Why is it called the bread of affliction?
For you came out of the land of Egypt in haste.
Well, affliction is the Hebrew word means poverty and trouble. So
more like trouble, not poverty, because they had received a tremendous amount of wealth from the Egyptians.
Yeah, but prior to that, they were living.
He's talking about that particular night they left out. Those 7 days for unleavened bread, you're to do this because it's called the bread of affliction. Why? Because you ran, you had to leave at a haste, trouble, a lot of trouble, time was going on. And what happened those 7 days?
They were
first day, second day, third day, all the way to the seventh day. What happened? Who was after them?
The Egyptians.
Pharaoh was after them. So they were in a haste. They were still being afflicted by the Egyptians and the Egyptian army. So he says, I want you to remember this. Now, as a Christian, how are you apply that to your life? How is that associated with you?
Well, let's see. If you're kind of taking the model of, you know, you take on the protector, and then you've got this period leading up to the time of baptism, then there obviously must be some time between the time that you decide to have God act as your, take on the Messiah as your protector, and the time of your baptism, there must be some sort of affliction that you face.
What is that affliction you face?
Satan's after you.
Who's after you?
Satan.
Yeah. The devil is after you. He wants to get rid of you. He wants to stop you from achieving that final goal. Okay? Now that we have reached that goal. But I want you to remember now. Go back and remember now that who your enemy is and why you had to do it in haste. A lot of you probably got baptized in a hurry. You're running from something. Sometimes you run from your own sins. Okay? But sometimes you were running from something else, yes.
Well, it would make sense, wouldn't it, that really as soon as you believe, you should be baptized. Constantine, for example, waited till the end of his life because to him it wasn't a real thing. Do you know what I'm saying? You believe, you repent, and you be baptized.
See, when I came to understand what I had to do, I didn't get baptized the day I believed.
No, but you do it soon.
I waited. Wow. You know, I was in the process of changing something, in the process of running away from the way the world is, how the world thinks, and how myself thought. So I've got to flee this thing in haste. So I didn't get baptized the day I believed. I got baptized several days later.
Yeah.
Share with them.
Yeah,
that's my experience.
Yeah.
It wasn't says, oh, some Christian guy says, yo, you got to be saved. Go get baptized. I said, oh, okay. That didn't happen to me at all. I have a reason to be baptized. I had a reason to be dunked in the water.
Philip and the eunuch, he said, right, I believe. There's a puddle. Come on. Baptize me.
But what was he doing?
He
was reading something in Isaiah, so his troubles were beginning to develop. It wasn't like all of a sudden he believes. He wanted to know what's going on because he was in fear. He was going to, when he was reading, it was terrifying him. He was afraid. He didn't do it because, oh yeah, it's a wonderful thing. Let's go get baptized.
What he read
troubled him. He was in terror. He was afraid. All right. That's where true repentance comes from, by the way.
Yeah.
What does it say? The fear of the Lord is the
beginning,
not the conclusion.
Right.
So the first thing you learn to have fear of God. Okay? But he's going to take you away from something. Okay. I want to bring that out. It can be very fascinating to know. By the way, these are called statutes. Verse 12. You should remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and you should be careful to observe these
statutes.
Now, that's different than law, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Remember? When we live according to the statutes, which we have customarily have been doing here, right? Feast of Tabernacles, Days of Unleavened Bread, Passover, Feast of Shavuot, we actually are establishing those statutes in our lives. Okay? Now we know wonderful blessings that come from that, not just because participated in it, but you understand God more, what He wants. Yes.
This is Moses was telling this to the second generation getting ready to enter the land.
Correct.
Isn't it odd that he's saying, remember that you were slaves? They weren't slaves. They weren't even born yet. Or maybe they were young.
Are you taking it as an individual or are you taking it as a nation? And Israel was as slave as a nation. Yes. Some of those kids were under the age of 20 in Egypt. Didn't mean everybody died. Brand new generation came on. It was those who were under the age of 20. Yeah, they would remember. And we also have Caleb still alive. We also have Joshua still alive. Yes.
And also to this day, the rabbis encourage and they taught, and this is evident too in the first century, that you, when you go to the Passover meal, you go as if you were that generation. It's an identification with Israel. Throughout history. So when you celebrate Passover today, it's as if it's happening now. That's what Zikor means, to remember. Yep. It's actually as a placing yourself in that.
Always remember where you came, what your roots were.
Yeah.
You know, remember where you came from. Well, where I came from, I came out of the land of Egypt. And New Testament talks about it as if you're coming out of sin. Remember, that's where you came from. You know, and sometimes we, I don't think we ever forget.
Yeah, because that's actually a common way that people dismiss Passover. They go, well, you know, it's just about remembering some exodus from slavery in Egypt. That's just ancient history, a nice little curiosity, but no real relevance for me today.
Well, the Apostle Paul says, don't you know you're a slave to what you obey? All right, you're a slave unto sin, you obey it. You're still in a bondage when you obey slave. I want to move to the 18th verse. You shall appoint judges and officers in all your gates, which the Lord will give you according to your tribes, and you shall judge, they shall judge people with just judgment. You should not pervert the justice. You should not show partiality. Or a bribe. In other words, whatever judge you appoint, whatever judge you pick, make sure he's the one that's not going to be being able to take a bribe. All right? And it's our, basically their responsibility, to pick the judge. Now, all he does is this is the qualification when you cross over that river, this is the qualification that you're going to have when you have to find a judge to begin to rule over you. Now, prior to them going into the land of Israel, who was their judge?
Moses.
And he had 70 men with him to rule it. But as you get in that new land, new territories, inside your gates, inside your cities, you're going to have to establish your own judges. And so when you establish your own judges, then make sure what kind of person you're picking to be your judge. Okay? Now, these are the qualifications. He will not and must not pervert justice. He shall have no partiality, nor take a bribe. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the righteous. You shall follow what is altogether just, and you shall live and inherit the land which the Lord your God has given you. So one of the requirements, one of the very interesting one, the very first requirements is appoint judges. Appoint officers. And now all of a sudden God's out of the picture. Because God's not picking them. Right? The people have to learn how to pick. And they don't do to the left nor go to the right. This is the direction I want you to go. You find an individual person who is like this. Now, Daniel's going through some judges, right? Did Deborah fit that role? Most certainly she did. All right? And a lot of those judges, as he goes through, they have to fit their role. If they don't fit their role, guess what happens? They're not judges. But he goes on to... Oh, you already commented about the tree. We won't go there. 17th chapter.
It's interesting that that's at the end of the thing on the appointed times, isn't it?
Correct.
It's very interesting that it's just to warn you. It's like you do not boil a kid in its mother's milk. That always comes at the end of the...
Exactly.
No, he's talking about a pig in the Canaanites used to boil milk in the
right, there's just, always in a section that's talking about the tithe.
Oh, the tithe as well. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but it's the peace.
But that's not the only end of the scene. Chapter 17 leads into after the appointed times. Because C-17 tells you something else, which is connected to the 16th chapter. Okay, the latter part of 16th chapter. Quite uniquely put together. You shall not sacrifice the Lord your God, or that's a zibach. You shall not have a zibach offering to the Lord your God, the bill of a bull or sheep, which is a blemish or defected. If, verse 2, if there is found among you, within your gates, with the Lord your God gives you, a man or a woman who has been wicked in the sight of the Lord your God in transgressing his covenant, who has gone to serve other Elohim or another Elohim and worship them. Now listen to these words. These are the other Elohim. Sun, the moon, and the stars. He really gets on to them about the sun and the moon and stars, doesn't he? One of the very biggest things, because see, the sun is not something you can make an image of in your house. The moon is not something you can make an image. A star, but they are things out there, right? And they are Elohim. Oh, did you ever think the sun was an Elohim? Do you ever think the moon was Elohim?
Of course, it creates tides. Very powerful.
Yes. They're meant to rule.
They're meant to rule. Okay, now see, you're getting now you're getting the picture. Okay, God set them in there. The interesting word he says that I have not commanded you to worship them. Well, what do you get? He talked about the appointed times, right? What are the appointed times involve? The sun and the moon and the stars. Did you ever catch that before? Let me ask you a question. Why is it that Abraham, before he was drawn out, worshipped the sun and the moon? It's a natural thing to do. It's a natural thing for people to do, because what does the sun do for you?
Warmth, light, crops growing.
You think that's the one that gives and brings forth life? I mean, without the sun, there's nothing there. What does the moon do at night?
It gives light.
Gives light at his appointed time. All right, kind of fascinating little things. A lot more involved in that than this, because I don't have that much time. But now, verse, continue on here now. And if indeed it is true that someone has done this, you are to have such an abomination, then you shall bring out of your gates that man or that woman who has committed the wicked thing. Now, the wicked thing is association with what?
Worship.
The covenant. He says, you've done an evil thing in what? Transgressing my covenant. What's the very first thing the command says?
Have the Lord your God with all your heart, all your mind, soul, and body.
No, covenant was, thou shalt have no other Elohim. Alright? Thou shalt not have no other Elohim. Now, that's a very fascinating thing about it, because listen, we came into this picture here, we're seeing it with the judgment, and we're talking about the appointed times, and the appointed times affect the sun, the moon, the stars. Alright? The only time you know when springtime comes is because what? As the earth rotates, the sun brings out. See, the earth has to rotate around the sun. The sun sources to rotate around the entire axis. And so the whole world is controlled and operated by the sun, the moon, the stars. All right, literally. We operate completely around the North Star. Yes.
And the stars also show us what season we're in, too.
It all shows what season you're in.
And you can imagine when those days when there wasn't any electric light, and particularly in that area of the world, the sun and the moon is huge, but the stars in the constellations and all of the, you know, the different yeah. Orion and all of the
it
things that
you
can see, it had to have had an effect on them.
Yeah. There we are. You know, yeah. You feel your life is being run by them.
Yeah.
Now, you know the,
yeah.
the, what's that organization that worships stars? Science of astrology. Okay, good enough. That happened way back then, didn't it? Always has. Mankind has wanted to worship and let their life be run by the stars
yeah.
or let it run by the moon.
Yeah.
And sun worshippers, the sun.
That's me.
Well, especially especially when you go out into a place where there is no, like out in the desert or something like that, and you look up into the sky, and you almost get awestruck by it.
Mm-hmm.
It just looks like glittering sand up there. It's really just awe-inspiring.
Now, I said in verse 6, whoever is deserving of death, meaning this particular situation we're talking about, because we're talking about the sun, the moon, the stars. All right? He says, he will not be put to death if only one person testifies and shows it, but you have to have more than two. Listen to verse 7. The hands of the witnesses shall be the first against him to put him to death. Okay, put yourself in this world. Let's suppose, no. Only ones who hear the testimony, not the entire community.
Oh, okay.
Okay. We have a community of how many people on court of law?
12.
We have 12 jurors. We have a judge. We have the prosecuting attorney. And we have persons up there stand, and somebody is witnessing against him. If it's proved, he says, you must diligently prove it. So they diligently prove it. They find out, oh, yes, this person is guilty. Guess who picks up the first stone?
The witness.
The two witnesses.
Yeah, the two witnesses.
And then the 12 who just convicted him. Then, wow, how effective would that be in our world, in our life today, if we actually had to do exactly what he said? I'll tell you one thing, you'd be very careful to make sure your testimony is true. Because if it's contrary, later on, prophets, you are the one that gets stoned. Now, I'll tell you what that would do to you as a human being, a flesh and blood. We're not talking about you get to pull electric lever. The only one person does that. We're talking the whole community, the 12, would be involved in the execution of this person. Why? Because you will put evil from among you. People will be terrified. How many times do you see people on television when they've been arrested and they say, hide your face from the camera? Well, no, it's a really embarrassing thing.
Yeah.
Well, you say, well, that's stupid and silly. But no, not really.
You're ashamed.
They should be ashamed.
Mm-hmm.
They should be ashamed.
Yeah.
If they're arrogant, what's the point?
No,
they should be ashamed.
Yeah.
And you would make you, if you had to pick up the stone first, you and your other witness had to pick up the stone first, you couldn't say, well, good, I want to get rid of him and hate him anyway. No, it's got a direct effect to your inner self. Because you cast the first one. Then the 12 cast theirs. You know, that's a pretty serious. Boy, you want to make sure that person is guilty. And also tell the rest of the community, says, boy, you know, I better watch and make sure I follow what God's had to say in the story.
Mm-hmm.
But if you took actions on yourself, sometimes we in our society today, because we want to eliminate the death sentence, I'll tell you, one way to eliminate the death sentence, have the juries and the witnesses stone them to death.
That's why
would end it quickly.
That's the reason they got liberated.
They would say
because as I recall, there was this saying in the Talmud that if a Sanhedrin in so many years
I think it's 300 or 400 years. Like
yeah, if a Sanhedrin in 300 years had convicted someone to death, it was considered bloody.
Right.
Because it very rarely
happens. It's very rare because it's a very serious charge.
We also convinced 70 people that this person deserved death, and that it had to be unanimous. That's hard to do.
That's hard to do, and it really is a serious thing matter. So you have to be very careful. And if the person, quote, who has done this evil thing, they can repent during the entire trial. They can turn and say, I no longer would. Because fear would be in the person. The fear would begin to have him to acknowledge the creator of heaven and earth, and then he'd begin to have fear, and then wisdom and understanding will come thereafter. I'll tell you, the woman that was at the woman that was going to be stoned,
yeah.
Do you think she was thinking casual? Or do you think she was terrified?
Well, she obviously was terrified.
Terrified. And when he said, go and sin no more, she probably said, yeah. I mean, she came close to being killed. So we know that Messiah gave your I will not judge you either, because of course he knew the heart. If I could turn around and reverse the conviction, he knows the heart. All right? All right, I want to get on to, I'm past my point, but I do want to say one thing down there, verse 9. You shall come, if it's too hard for your community to do this, if you can't do it, you're unable to come together on an agreement of executing this person because it's a real serious matter. Nobody in the community really, really wants to do this. Well, if it's too hard for you to make a decision, let's go to now the priest and a judge in those days. Well, there could be a higher judge, a higher Supreme Court, we say. You go to a higher Supreme Court. And the priest. And then whatever they decide, you must carry out. And it comes on to the other point where he says, now, verse 12, after the decision has been made by the judges, or the judge at that time, or the priest at that time, and you still do not want to carry out the assignment, guess what happens to you, verse 12. You're going to die. That's how serious God is. That's how serious the Torah is. Now we're going back to what it said, 16th chapter, the appointed times. And we go into the sun, the moon, the stars. We start thinking, what is this picture telling us? Wow, has to do with what? This covenant. Oh, you made an agreement with God. Yes.
Just this verse 12 there, 12 and 13, about someone who shows contempt for the judge or the priest there.
In this case, the priest, yeah.
Is that bearing to what the Apostle Paul said about having respect for the authorities?
Yeah. They're there to do what? Carry out.
Wield the sword.
That's right. Wield the sword. Okay. And the last thing I want to say is this one. You shall, about a king. We've already discussed some of that. Now, God gave the criteria that when you come to point, you're going to have a king over your nation, verse 17, verse 14. Now moved into another category by the principle of the governing. You shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. Okay, now, we are to set over us a king. In this case, sometimes a president in our country. Now, we set up a king over us. What is the criteria? What's the criteria? It's the one that God chooses. And you say, well, I don't know which one God wants. That guy's running, she's running, they're all running. Which one does God choose? What are you thinking going to choose? Are they turning to the left? Are they turning to the right? He didn't choose them. He didn't choose them, did he? You don't pick someone who is turning from the statutes of God. You can't pick somebody who is turning to the left and turning to the right. And guess what our political situation is? You're either on the left or on the right.
Yeah.
Nobody likes someone in the middle of the road. Right? Of course, that's also a negative political term either. But I understand, brother. It's a negative terminology. But so when we start looking at who should be our king, our president, our governor, our mayor, he says, when you choose them by how I would choose them. How does God choose them? He doesn't come down and says, by the way, I'm voting this one. You're going to vote for him too? He didn't vote at all, does he? He says, no, this is the criteria. How do we know this? He says, this is the criteria of how you pick a judge. This is the criteria on how you pick a king. Yes.
There's a very old philosophical argument that says that the person who does not make a choice has already made a choice. The one who chooses not to decide has already made a choice. So if you are presented with a slate of candidates that are all bad and you decide not to
already made a choice,
and you're basically going with the default position of whoever gets the majority of votes, aren't you?
Well, they're they're supposed to put in the ballot, none of the above. They can start putting that on some of the states are going to try that out and say, put them down the bottom, none of the above, and see how many votes they get from that statement. Then you'd make a choice. No, as I said before, I'd have a hard time. If I had two people running for governor, California, both of them go contrary to God 100%, I'm not going to pick either one of them. I will have nothing on that ballot.
So you don't have to advocate the lesser of two evils.
Though. No, I do not. There is
no such thing. Evil is evil.
That's right.
That's not where it comes from.
There's only righteousness and unrighteousness. There's only the left hand and the right hand when it comes to the word of God. Choose life or choose death. I tell you to choose life.
Amen.
If you choose death, I'm sorry, it's all over with for you. You know. Mm-hmm. What, can darkness have companion with light?
No.
It can't. So you can't really put the light is good, darkness is evil, spiritually speaking, right? How can you vote for those who are in the gray? Now listen. Those who are in the gray are on the verge of either entering into the light or entering into darkness. Right? They're in the rising toward the light or in the setting toward light and heading toward darkness. All right?
So then what do you do if you're faced with the lesser of two evils choice and you decide not to choose any of the evils?
I do not choose any of the evils.
Then you don't.
That's why myself, personally.
Then you don't have to share the responsibility of putting somebody in office that's going to lead us away from God.
Correct.
But do you then have the responsibility of basically informing other people that the choices available are not the right choices?
That's what I do. When they ask me who I'm going to vote for, I says neither one of them. Why? Well, because. And I give them wrong. I says, oh, okay. They're satisfied with that answer. Every time someone asks me, who'd you vote for? And I said, I didn't vote for anybody. Why? Well, because that person does this, that person does that, contrary to everything the Word of Living God. Oh, they'll accept that. Because basically a no vote is a vote.
Okay.
It really is a vote.
So then are we in some degree responsible for, I guess, spreading the light of choice to the people around us?
If they're willing to hear, yes. But don't throw pearls unto swines. But you might be able to throw them to someone who really wants to know. So you can be careful who you're throwing your pearls to, right? You answer fool according to folly, or you don't answer fool according to folly. See, that's your judgment. Figure out what that's going to be. It's not God's. It's yours. I'm running out of time here. About copying, he must copy a book of the Torah, or the Lord, or the scroll. Basically, he's talking about the book of Deuteronomy. It's primarily the book of Deuteronomy, because Deuteronomy talks about all sorts of statutes on how to be run, how to do it, how to live your life, including one about a king. The rest of them don't mention anything about a king, but this one does mention about how a king should be, or a judge should be. Yes?
I wonder if when this was the point, and when Josiah tore his clothes when he realized that he was supposed to have a copy of this.
Yeah. I haven't heard that one before. Interesting topic statement. Verse 20, that his heart may not be lifted above his brethren, and that he may not turn aside from the commandments. To the right or to left. So every time you say left hand, right hand, left to the right, I would remember it. It's the commandments number one. If you turn left or right, what does it mean by turning left or turning to the right?
Turning away from the straight and narrow.
Turning away from the straight and narrow. So you turn to the right, which direction are you turning to?
Away.
And you turn to the left, which direction are you turning to?
Away.
Away. They're both away. Okay? The wrong direction. And he says that his may be long in his day of his kingdom, and his children in the midst of Israel.